The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Splendid Food edition of Slate Money, your guide to the most delicious food of the week. And with us here in Gowanus, Brooklyn, we have Jordan Weissman.
Hello, everybody.
Anna Szymanski.
Hi again.
And coming up on stage right now, Mr. Teddy Goff. Big hand for Mr. Teddy Goff, who's right here. Have a seat, Teddy. Teddy is a man of many talents. I've known him for a few years. He helped to launch the amazing franchise that is Fusion. He also helped to launch the amazing franchise that was Barack Obama. But mostly, he helped to launch the amazing... Is it a franchise? There's only one so far, right?
Of Barack Obama, there is only one. Yeah, he said was, which is why I gave you a look. He still is.
He still is Barack Obama. But yeah, Black Tap is a burger joint and Instagram sensation, which is in the West Village, right?
There's a few. The original was in Soho. There's one in the West Village. There's one at 55th. And there's a couple in Dubai.
Okay.
Wait, Dubai?
Really?
Yeah.
But how did you make that jump?
You know, there's. If you've ever, I had a layover in Dubai once. I don't know if you've ever. You, Felix Salmon is certainly. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, there's. It's interesting. There, you know, you go and you know, it's like an American mall. I mean, there's an Eataly there, and if you walk into the Eataly, it looks exactly like the Eataly on 23rd Street. Okay. There's Shake Shacks. There's everybody.
There's also like a Statue of Liberty, I'm assuming.
Exactly.
And yeah. So you are in Dubai duty free. If you have a few hours to kill, you can get yourself a Black Tap burger. Just like the one in Soho. Mm-hmm. So Teddy is the master of buzz. A quick like show of hands. How many of you guys have heard of Black Tap?
All right.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well done.
I feel like the people who are not raising their hands have probably seen their product at some point. And yeah. So we want to talk to you about food, how buzz in restaurants is generated, but
because yeah, this is the This is the big question about restaurants, which the first segment which I'm going to ask here in general is, do we actually go to restaurants for the food?
Yeah, but so I think... So just as a little bit more. So if you haven't, if you don't recognize the name Black Tap, again, if you've been on Instagram and you know, I spend personally a lot of time just staring at food porn, and I swear to God, your milkshakes... Your ice cream sundaes have shown up more times on my feed, and as a result,
so we're that's them.
Right here.
Okay, I'm right here. I can hear you say that.
Yeah. And so you were like the number two most tweeted about restaurant in, is it New York or the country?
New York. Yeah,
because of this thing right here. These giant.
Largely, yeah. I mean, as we were talking about backstage, we actually have fantastic burgers, but the kind of I think the aura of the milkshake has kind of subsumed the brand to some degree.
So I want to like, what is the story behind this thing? That is like, I mean, that is like sort of what you guys now have like lines outside of your restaurant, like or your locations. All of them, or are they all like swarmed, or is it just a few? Of them?
Yeah, they're all pretty swarmed. You know, it's funny because the original concept we started talking about it. Gosh, back in 20 sort of around Christmas 2013, January, February, March of the next year. And the original concept was that it would be this very, you know, it's called Black Tap because in the original location, there is a black beer tap with 18, I think, beers on tap, mostly local, mostly craft. And it was going to be this, you know, sort of.
Oh my God, you were like a hipster artisan quaint experience burger joint.
Exactly. So that was the original idea.
And, so you know,
and then you went to Dubai.
Yeah. You know, and when we opened it, it still was that, and to some degree it still is. I mean, it has that look, and it's, you know, the music is like Zeppelin and Stones, and you know, and it's sort of a cool place in there, and they were all and it was supposed to be kind of this ode to the lunch counter. I mean, milkshakes, fries, burgers, counter seating only at first. We've since expanded into the basement and then to 55th Street.
And then what made you think that you had any particular ability to open? I mean, it's not like no one's thought of having a burger and beer joint before, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, for me personally, the whole thing started, I mean, truly with a joke to a family friend that I said I wanted to quit my job and open up a bar. And he said, you know, I have some friends who do this kind of thing for a living. You might want to talk to them. And I said, I wasn't, you know, serious, but I, okay. And about 18 months later, Black Tap was born. And I should say I'm by no means the prime mover behind it. I mean, the real creative, genius is a guy named Joe Isidori, who has had a fantastic career as a chef long before Black Tap.
So when you were talking to Joe about this idea, are you doing that whole kind of, oh my God, I want to own a bar which will have great beers and great burgers and it'll be a neighborhood joint and everyone will feel at home and like that kind of cliche? Or are you actually jumping one step ahead and saying, hey, we can be really big on Instagram?
Definitely the former. Now, I think for Joe, it might have been the latter. I mean, not Instagram per se, but I mean, I think Joe saw, you know, franchise potential and growth potential. You know, for me personally, I just thought it'd be fun. You know, I always think owning a restaurant or a bar is like a much lower net worth individual's version of trying to own a sports team. I mean, you know, it's just kind of fun. And, you know, it's funny, you mentioned Obama earlier. In all sincerity, I've had more congratulations and more old friends pop out of the wood work over Black Tap than I did over the election and re-election of Barack Obama. I mean, like sincerely. So, you know, people just find it cool. And to this day, I mean, I had like a friend from second grade, you know, sort of find out that I was associated with it and contact me on Facebook. So I think for me, it was that. And I think for Joe, I mean, Joe, I think had a bigger vision.
Joe wanted to take over the world is sort of, or at least Dubai, get to Dubai. So what? But like, what's the story behind these? Because these have sort of been the secret to your guy. I mean, the burgers are good, like you said, but it's these things, these very, very visually stunning statues of ice cream and Sour Patch Kid
so
or whatever.
So those of you listening along at home, Jordan decides that he needs to talk to the ice cream when he's saying
it. He's so compelling.
You can't take it's pulling us in.
But yes. Yeah, I mean, so like, where do they come from? So was that like conscious thing or like?
So there were always milkshakes from the beginning, but they were not as statuesque at the beginning. And Joe's then girlfriend, now wife, is a big fan of cotton candy. And I guess at one point asked him to make her a milkshake with cotton candy. And he, as the legend goes, you know, sort of got together with some of the other cooks and, you know, makes this gigantic, again, statuesque milkshake, and she loves it. And we start selling not just that, but the one with the cookie and the one with the cake. And now, you know, now there's theme ones for different seasons and, you know, different promotions. You know, it's important. It's funny because, I mean, in all sincerity, you know, Joe's like a pretty serious chef. At one point he was a chef at a Michelin starred restaurant. You know, the idea of this being a really good burger joint with really good burgers and, by the way, really good milkshakes that happen to look a certain way, but also taste great was always sort of important to us. But obviously the look is the thing that drives
right,
the sensation.
Just,
yeah.
I'm just wondering now if a lot of chefs are thinking of Instagram when they're creating their dishes. I mean, is that kind of
or
what
more is to the point, is there any chef who isn't
right,
thinking
yeah.
of Instagram, given that, like, what is it, 89% of Instagram is pictures of food?
Yeah. I mean, of course. And look, I mean, the whole restaurant PR business is really kind of built around Instagram and Instagrammers and, you know, these sort of food Instagram people with a few hundred thousand people and getting them in for early tastes and, you know, early looks at the food and all that. So, you know, I can't imagine
and is that changing food, do we think? I mean, in
Of course. I mean, I think, you know, look at like the phenomenon of the Tasty video, the BuzzFeed, you know, I mean, I wonder how many people cook these things at home, but I mean, I presume that sort of all around the country, there's people, you know, whose home cooking habits are now built around, you know, making like rolls that have smiley faces on
right.
them, and,
yeah.
you know, and this whole sort of Instagram and Facebook
bread,
friendly. Yeah, exactly.
So you're like a social media like strategist, partly like that is like one of your, so was this, so you have these, you know, shakes that or sundaes that look like the Mars factory exploded on them. Like, sorry.
On behalf of Joe, I object to that, but go on. Yeah.
Like, I mean, did it just kind of unfold naturally from there, or was there like a conscious way you said, okay, here's how we're going to generate more buzz off this? How
it was a little bit of both. There was to some degree it was organic, to some degree there were a couple of things that happened. I mean, one of the things that happened in January of 2016, BuzzFeed did a post called something like New York is going crazy off of these next level milkshakes. And what I always joke about that post is at the time I don't know if you'd say New York was going crazy over it, but but after that they started to, and so that there was this crazy
fulfilling BuzzFeed.
Exactly. So that becomes their number one post of the week, and you know, I mean, like BuzzFeed. I forget. I think it was the Today Show, but it might have been Good Morning America. You know, then we had morning shows the next day, and then we were off and running. So, I mean, to some degree, you had this product that was Instagram friendly, designed to be delicious and fun, but obviously Instagram friendly. You had this kind of rocket fuel provided by BuzzFeed, and then I think Today Show, and then you had this kind of organic thing that started around it, where all of a sudden, I mean, I remember I got, you know, that was just such a fun month, January, February, as this whole thing was starting. At one point, I checked out our location tag on Instagram just to see what people were saying. And somebody said, the line was too long at Black Tap, so I had to go to get a cronut instead. And that's how you know you've arrived, you know?
So I have for me, there's like two parallel things going on in the restaurant industry. One is the sort of like the seats merge Jonathan Gold. I have found the most amazing Laotian place in a strip mall in Flushing. You know, and it's, you know, incredibly delicious, and you have to get onto the three different subways and five buses to get there. And then the other one is kind of what you're doing, this kind of very visual, punchy, much more accessible. You kind of don't even need to eat it to enjoy it. You know, the very buzzy restaurants, often in hotels, which just like are full of celebrities and everyone goes there to be seen. And then what seems to get lost in the middle is what we all generally consider a normal restaurant, where you don't need to go to the middle of nowhere, and you can just walk in and get a table and have a nice meal and walk out. Like, is that being sort of squeezed in this kind of weird barbell?
I don't know. I think probably to some degree, but I mean, look, I think, you know, hiding under the surface of, you know, the meals that you Instagram is probably the six dinners out of seven that you don't Instagram, at which you may be home cooked, or maybe, you know, from a diner or a neighborhood restaurant. So, I mean, I think, like, obviously there is this, increasing desire for all those, you know, both sides of that barbell, you're talking about, but, you know, I don't know. I think most people don't, want a gourmet burger every day, even if it's delicious. And I think most people don't want to go to the strip mall in Queens every day, even if that's delicious. And, you know, and I think there is kind of a love for, you know, what we consider just good old fashioned American food that doesn't exactly go away, even if the prevalence of it kind of gets chipped at over the years.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Let's bring on Francis, shall we?
We're going to talk about vegetables now after talking about...
Yeah, because...
So much meat and dairy.
Because... we're gonna have this has been carefully orchestrated to get the burger joint guy on with the cookbook guy. Where is Francis? Come on stage. We have our second special guest here, Mr. Francis Lam. Come have a seat on the cozy sofa here. Francis has a awesome podcast. It is called The Splendid Table. It is a splendid podcast, and everyone should use the word splendid as often as possible because it's a splendid word.
Thank you for renaming your show after us today. That was really, I saw that. That touched me.
And you also make cookbooks for a living. That is actually your job.
I'd like to think both those things are my job. I mean, I do things for love and passion, but, you know, also to, like, feed my child.
So yeah, Francis, you've done, like, I don't know, like a dozen cookbooks. And so we are going to talk to you about cookbooks later. But first, we want to ask you, or rather Anna wants to ask you about vegetarianism, because we have the burger guy here. And we have the vegetarian here. And so Anna's going to take the lead on this one, but you're going to start off by explaining to us, because I've asked you this question like five times and you've never answered it. And now I'm going to ask you on stage and you're going to have to answer it, which is why?
I actually have like the world's weirdest explanation for why I am a vegetarian. I've been on and off vegetarian for like 20 years. I'm on now for a while, but it's mainly just because I really like placing restrictions on myself. Like, really, honestly.
You're like Mark Zuckerberg. It's just like random this year.
It's kind of true.
I mean, only things I kill.
Yeah, I mean, like, I do care about animals and animal welfare, but I'm not going to lie. It's also just because, like, I like to have limits. I'm a very structured individual.
Discipline.
Yes, exactly.
I'd buy that.
Yeah. So, but speaking of burgers and vegetarianism, one of the things I kind of have been interested in is that so much of the discussion around vegetarian food over the past, you know, I don't know, 5 years or so, has really shifted to this kind of Silicon Valley VC-driven quest for the non-meat meat alternative. And I find that to be a really weird movement in vegetarian food, because it doesn't really seem to be aimed at vegetarians. It seems to be much more aimed at meat eaters.
Yeah, people who are eating his burgers. Like, that's, yes.
Right.
So they won't eat his burgers.
Teddy, would you, would you ever serve a vegetarian burger at Black Tap?
We do, actually. We have two. We have a falafel burger and then a more traditional veggie burger.
Would you
I don't know whether we do like an impossible burger. I would have to.
Falafel burger I can get behind.
Really?
Right. Okay. Yeah, because that's not trying to be meat. You know, it's just trying to be a really interesting vegetable burger. But this idea of trying to create, like, I'm going to create a veggie burger that bleeds. Because it's like vegetarians were like, you know what I was missing? The blood.
God, if only I could get more blood in my life.
Exactly.
But I mean, but that's the thing, right? Like, so, you know, everyone, the reason people are now aiming to create veggie burgers that bleed, and that's like the Impossible Foods burger. I feel like that talking about a buzz food, right? People started serving that. How many people have heard about this? The burger that bleeds, show of hands. So, So
we were just on email today. I had one in Houston, Texas. This has really made it, you know,
how was it?
It was great.
Yeah.
I like them. And Ryan Sutton was just on Eater today raving about the vegetarian chicken sandwich at Superiority Burger. Like, this is a thing. Yeah. It is tofu. Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to hijack this, but can we talk about how weird it is that this Impossible Burger is talked about as inevitably people say it's the veggie burger that bleeds?
Yes.
Because a burger doesn't fucking bleed.
Right, exactly.
Like, I don't care if you have like raw meat, you kind of like blood.
What birds? Burgers are eating.
Like, for some reason, like, we've like really caught in that idea.
But for the record, when you see the red juice coming out of a burger or a piece of meat, that's not blood.
Yeah. Well,
but I think the thing that's interesting about that is it's sort of doing what you're talking about, which is keying into, this maybe is redundant, but I think you all get it, like the carnality of meat, mm-hmm. and keying into the sort of, you know, that what we think stereotypically of the meat eater's urge of like this, like, you know, cave person who wants to go and like destroy another animal for sustenance, right. And like, you know, like keying into that thing. And maybe we're overthinking it. Maybe it's just the idea that, hey, people really like how burgers taste because they've grown up eating burgers. And if we can get people to eat a burger that's not actually made of cow and animal, then we're doing the earth a better service. I remember reading years ago this stat, which is that if everyone in America ate one, like changed their diet to eat one vegetarian day a week, it would do as much for carbon emissions as taking every single car off the road.
No, I completely agree with you. And I think this is actually something that Felix and I, one of the few things we'll agree on, is that it seems like, yes, obviously people should be eating less meat, but you could just eat less meat. It seems like odd that the way to get people to eat less meat is to spend all this time and energy creating a meat-like facsimile when there's so much other food that's not meat.
And more generally, it's odd to try and persuade people to eat less meat by extolling whatever suspect virtues there might be to vegetarianism. Like, you don't need to go to zero. If you cut your meat consumption by 90%, you're 90% of the way there, and you can still have meat on special occasions.
I guess I'm a little confused by the confusion, right? Like, I think 3% of Americans are vegetarian, right? Like, that's all, it's like...
3%?
Yeah, you're the elite. And so, like, there are, you know, and so obviously it's hard to get people to convert all the way, and getting people... Even when you're telling them to eat less meat, still they like to have something they can think of as a burger or something like it. And so if a few people in Silicon Valley want to throw money at trying to create a product that will lure people into eating less meat, I'm not quite sure I see the harm. Or, you know, it's not as if Francis, maybe you can talk about how the food media focuses its attention, but it doesn't seem like there's a finite amount of oxygen with which to talk about these issues. Like, you can talk about the substitutes and also just reducing the amount of food meat that Americans eat. I mean,
I don't entirely disagree. I just think that I think that the idea that we're actually going to get to a burger or other, again, meat, ersatz meat products that actually tastes like meat is probably never going to happen.
We're there already. We're almost there.
I mean, like, yes, but is that ever going to taste as good as like an actual, like the best burger? Probably
no,
not.
It'll taste better than 85% of burgers.
Sure. And okay. But again, I just don't see why. Because I don't really see the market for this product long term.
I'm going to give you one market for this question, for this burger rather, which is, I love eating vegetarian food and I love eating vegetarian meals, and I'm always very happy that someone else is making them because they're incredibly hard work to make. And if you give me a pre-made burger which tastes like a delicious burger and all I need to do to cook it is throw it in a pan with like 4 minutes on either side, that's making my vegetarian meal so much easier than virtually any vegetarian meal I could otherwise cook.
I don't know. Grilled cheese is pretty easy.
Teddy.
Well, I was going to say, don't you think there are a lot of people who sort of buy the moral argument for vegetarianism, but just sort of don't want to do it? Right? I mean, so who buy either, you know, animal cruelty or climate or whatever the reasons are, but just crave a burger. So to me, that's a market.
It's a very, because again, you're talking about a market of people who care enough about these issues to want to spend a lot of money on this product, but don't care enough that they want to just become vegetarian. And how often are they going to eat this product? Again, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, obviously. I just think that the idea, because when you hear people in Silicon Valley talk about this, it's the like, this is the, you know, the disruptive product that's going to change everything. And I'm like, is
that is the way they talk about everything.
Yeah.
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 Give them that. We're going to disrupt toilet paper. Yeah, we're going to blow the toilet paper world up.
But this is like, this is like one of the few times I kind of admire that attitude. Like, very, I don't really care what they're doing with toilet paper, but like,
it's
selling diapers or whatever, but like the, you know, there are a few companies right now that are, for instance, trying to do lab-grown meat. This is like a really big thing. And who knows if it's ever going to pan out. There's some serious scientific challenges they still have to resolve to ever make it.
Fetal bovine.
Yeah, zero. Right. I mean, like right now, the way you produce lab-grown meat, like people have known how to culture cells forever, but you have to literally use a serum that is extracted from cow fetuses and then bathe the cells in that to grow them. I mean, it's
super vegetarian.
Yeah, exactly.
we prefer the term marinate.
Yeah, marinate. Exactly. delicious. But so anyway, like, but one day, let's say they were able to bring down, like, find a substitute for said serum and bring down the cost, you know, would anyone really care if their chicken nugget was grown in a lab? At this point, it might as well be. So,
oh, yes. And I can tell you, I mean, again, talking about 3%, if there are 3% of people who are vegetarian, there are also this very aggressively evangelical and fast-growing movement of what's known as effective altruists. And once you start going into the effective altruism movement, you discover that the thing they really care most about in the world is chickens.
Okay.
That's true. Yeah.
So wouldn't they want the chicken meat grown in a lab without any actual chickens?
Absolutely. Okay. Because it's like the thing you can do to with the least cost to yourself to alleviate the most suffering on planet Earth is to stop eating chicken.
Okay.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting question. How are you defining pain?
So you can define it.
Is it the individual being that matters, right? Oh, okay.
To make
300 pounds of chicken meat, right? You need 600 chickens.
Right.
To make 300 pounds of cow meat, you need half a cow.
Exactly.
So you're costing 300 chickens worth of pain versus one cow's worth of pain.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, from an environmental perspective, if you're like vegetarian curious, or not even if you're just like, you know, you just want to be like more environmentally conscious in terms of your meat eating choices, the single best thing you can do is eat less beef and eat more chicken. Actually, it's eat more wild caught fish, and, but that's another,
you know, well, vegetarian for that matter. But
right. But if you're going to be a carnivore,
basically, even if you assume that chickens suffer, you know, 5% of the amount that like humans do or cows do or anything else, you're still better off stopping eating chickens, just because you have to kill so many chickens to eat your annual chicken.
Okay, and I'm just going to say this though, as the vegetarian though, it's like, where do you draw that line though? Like, because an insect is also a being that you're killing. I mean, like
I'm a strong believer that oysters are vegetarian.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a nervous system, so they don't suffer.
Peter Singer was actually said that you could eat, like he said, vegans could ethically eat oysters, famously. Like, it's the one living organism that a vegan is.
It sounds like an oyster lover is. Yeah.
Ironically, the oyster is kosher for vegans. That's
Just like side note here, this is a really good year for oysters right now. I don't know if you've noticed that like oysters, that there are good years and bad years, but this winter is like, go out, eat lots of oysters. They're really good this year.
Even if you're vegetarian.
Especially if you're vegetarian.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, there's a legit argument for it. I mean, Peter Singer, like, you know, I would defer to his, but there's actually a really good environmental case for eating oysters, because oysters filter the water, right? They literally clean the water they live in. So the more oysters you eat, the more people will want to grow them, the cleaner water you have. It's actually like you're doing good for the world if you eat oysters.
So, Anna, why don't you eat oysters?
I actually just don't like oysters.
It's as good as F.
Wait, so I want to go back to the moonshot though, like the Silicon Valley. Like, so Teddy, like, could you sell lab grown meat? Do you think, like, if it came out, like, or how would you sell lab grown meat at this moment at a burger place?
You'd make it look really good on Instagram.
Yeah, I mean that. I don't know. I hesitate to say anything that our chef would disagree with, but I think that for us that is, you know, sort of contrary to the brand, the whole idea of sort of old fashioned, old school. You know, again, Zeppelin on the radio, and you know, a good old fashioned burger and fries,
and rainbow unicorn milkshakes, which are just totally old fashioned.
It's a complex brand. It's a brand that we've kind of bent in a couple different shapes. So I don't know, that to me doesn't feel like us. I would personally eat one.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to. I'd be intrigued by it. But so would you, and it's like, do you want people just to talk more about, like, what would you prefer the vegetarian movement of the moment to be? What would your—
Again, I think that if people want to be vegetarian, there is so much fantastic vegetarian food from so many different cultures that you can eat. And again, I'm not saying you can't eat these other products. I just think, I'm just not entirely sure what the point of them is. And I think overall, if we really want to, again, focus on the environmental issues or the animal suffering issues, I actually think there are far better ways to do that. And I think this is more about this kind of like Silicon Valley God complex than it is about actually trying to fix any of these
problems. Okay, so let's be servicey here. And, you know, if I care about animal welfare and animal suffering, what is the far better way that what should I be doing?
I mean, I think if you look at even like lobbying, when they lobby to get like fast food restaurants to use cage-free eggs, or to try to get like in, I think, New Jersey to try to stop getting, New Jersey, maybe Iowa, to stop having pigs in crates, like some of those like actual policy changes, to me, again, that is going to do a lot more than like one person once every 6 months eating an extremely expensive fake burger. I just, it's going to make you feel good. Is it actually going to do anything? No.
Okay. I think that's our vegetarian segment. On which note, we're going to defenestrate Teddy Goff.
I can just leave. You don't need to do that.
You don't actually have to go.
But he will be back for the Q&A. So any questions you have about, unicorn milkshakes, tweet them at hashtag Slate Live, and we will drag him back and force him to answer your questions.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Do you want to come sit? Like, yeah. are you feeling cozy over there? Do you want to come sit?
Not if you throw people out the window. Sit right here, dog.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the official defenestration of Teddy Goff is, well, I can't say because his mum's in the audience, and so we mustn't.
They're doing terrible things to him back there. If you listen closely, you can hear the scream.
am I going to really, I don't want to, this is your show, so I definitely don't want to derail your show, but can I talk a little bit more about the Silicon Valley burger?
Yeah, sure. If you want.
Because it's actually a really fascinating conversation to be had here that actually has probably nothing to do with money, so I apologize. But no, I'll just put it out here, and if we don't like it, you know, this is not going live to tape, so you can cut it out.
Yeah, we can just cut it.
You know what? This is going to be our Slate Plus segment.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
It's so good, it's plus, which really means it was minus in real life.
Okay, but that cut close to home, man.
Okay, so I feel a little bit badly because for those who didn't raise their hands when we talked about an Impossible Burger, so probably a little bit of explanation to get to my question I want to ask all of you.
Yeah.
Is so the Impossible Burger is this burger that is not lab grown meat, in that it's not like taking cow cells and then trying to like replicate cow cells by making them grow themselves or whatever lab grown meat is. But it is a burger made of plant materials, but has actually taken, like, found a way to find, like, oh, the thing in, like, soybean roots or something like that, that is closest to, like, animal blood, that gives it that red color, but also gives it that sort of tinny, metallic blood meat flavor, and is, like, creating this thing that looks like ground beef and cooks like ground beef and tastes almost, like, 98% of the way there to like what you would close your eyes and just be, oh, that's ground beef. So it's kind of an amazing feat of science, right?
Yeah.
And they're continually refining the recipe to get closer and closer to 100% where you really can't tell the difference between ground beef and this
the burger
product.
Equivalent of the Turing test.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But once they get there, maybe even now, because I think most people like wouldn't tell that, you know, that 2% difference is probably not meaningful to them. Then you have to ask yourself, what is meat? Is meat basically a chemical formula, a structure that creates an object in the world that smells a certain way and cooks a certain way and tastes a certain way? Or does meat have to be the product of killing an animal for your food?
I love this question. I love it because it's the difference between the Anglo-Saxon names and the French names, right? It's the difference between the cow and the beef, between the pork and the pig. It's the difference, like, there's an animal and then there's the food. And if you're talking about the food, you're really talking about the experiential object rather than the, you know, species.
Right.
So, and yeah, I can totally see that in some weird kind of experiential way, it is me.
Whoa.
But no, but
dorm room.
But here's the question, and this is actually the question of market,
not
right?
Once.
As a consumer, a literal consumer, do you feel like you're actually getting meat if you know it wasn't killed right. from an animal? Like it wasn't taken from a live creature? And does that matter to you? I mean, that's the literal billion-dollar question these companies are asking themselves, right?
Yeah, and I also think this is interesting when you, I mean, this is maybe off topic, but like why people become vegetarians and like in so many food restrictions in general that I often think are far less about the food itself than it is about defining your identity around what you do and do not consume.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, I think I was actually listening to people connected to kind of the lab-grown beef movement talking about like, oh, well, you know, we could create this, you know, pork alternative so then Muslims would be able to eat pork and we could create, you know, this other alternative and kosher Jews would be able to eat this. And I'm like, right, but that's not the point.
Right.
The point isn't the food itself. It's that you define yourself by what you do and do not do.
Mm.
So,
right. I feel like a lot of Orthodox Jews would be very happy to get pork they were suddenly allowed to eat. Like our religion, Judaism is good at finding workarounds. Like it's a lot of our religion.
If anybody ever manages to create a vegetarian hamon, then like that's like 24th century crazy shit right there. But no, you're absolutely right, and it does open up new vistas while at the same time kind of opening up interesting questions. Like, is this like a loophole? I mean, Jews love loopholes, but like for people who aren't, you know, people who are more like principled vegetarian, you know, I don't eat meat. If it looks like a duck and quacks like, if it basically feels like meat and tastes like meat, are you kind of cheating yourself by eating it?
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I mean, I think there's something interesting to be said for that because I mean, I'm not saying this is why people should be vegetarian, but the history of vegetarianism is often about like, you know, asceticism and this idea of suffering and this idea of, you know, not having something. And it's almost as much as the lack of suffering is the fact that you're not consuming something. So if then you are consuming the simulacrum of that, what's the point?
Which is also explain why there are only 3% of Americans right now who are vegetarians.
This is true.
But this is also the perfect segue to cookbooks.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
You know, I spend a small amount of time in bookstores looking at cookbook sections. And for something which is ostensibly only 3% of 2% of Americans, by God, there are a lot of vegetarian cookbooks out there. And I mean, obviously everyone likes to be able to cook vegetarian food, even if they're not vegetarian, but it is hard. And every vegetarian cookbook will have this long introduction saying, it's not hard, it's easy. And then you're like, you're lying to me. And then, and yeah, there's like, have you ever come across, would you ever publish like an honest vegetarian cookbook saying like, this is, you're just going to have a gazillion different herbs and spices, most of which you've never heard of, and the 12 different vegetables, and it's really hard, and you're chopping for hours, and then at the end of it, you don't feel full.
It's a bestseller.
I mean, probably you, if you wanted to go there, you'd probably, yeah, I would publish that book, because that'd be hilarious. But the reality is, you know, I disagree with the idea that vegetarian food is hard. You know, on its face, some of it is more complex, and you know, it's a, but you know, a lot of it is like, so much of cooking is just muscle memory and practice, right? And so much of cooking is about
even vegetarian cooking.
Even vegetarian cooking.
I feel like all my favorite vegetarian cuisines, like whether they're Indian or Mexican, you just know that like there's been days of work going into these things.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but like, you know, but at the same time, like you'll go to like you'll go to a restaurant, open up, and be like, here's the 72-hour short rib, and you're like, oh, sweet, hook me up with a 72-hour short rib. You know, like I think, you know, there, like anything, it's about okay, if we want to get into like just cooking, you know, yes, you can get a lot of flavor pretty easily out of a piece of meat. But I think in large part because you're just accustomed to that being the central focal point of the meal, right? And so like, oh, if I know, you know, what kind of steak or chop I'm going to sear on the stove and finish in the oven tonight, I'm 85% of the way there to dinner. And then I'm just going to make a salad on the side and, you know, whatever. I'm going to like, you know, throw some broccoli in the oven with the pork and I'm done. But if you change your way of thinking to cooking, so for instance, I eat meat and I love meat, but I cook almost entirely vegetarian at home just because it's easier for me and the way I live and the way like my family lives. So like on Sunday, I'll boil, oh my God, I'm going to sound like such a freaking Brooklyn cliche right now. I'm so sorry. But I'll boil up some like, you know, some farro or some, oh God, I was going to say quinoa.
He's boiling quinoa. All right, people.
But I'll boil
Don't
up something.
Worry, it's safe. We're in Brooklyn.
Some kind of grain or some. I just like cook a big pot of rice in my rice cooker, which is, you know.
You can put quinoa in the rice.
For those of you at home, you can't see me. I'm Chinese, and Chinese people cook their rice in a goddamn rice cooker. They'll come and be like, oh, what's your method for the pot and the fire? No, we turn on a rice cooker. It's how we always done it. Anyway. We didn't eat rice before rice cookers. We ate like weird wheat shit. No, but seriously, I'll have a big pot of like, you know, something that will be my base, and probably I'll roast, you know, two or three vegetables in the oven simply so I can like, you know, mess with them later in the week. And then, you know, that'll end up being three of my meals for the week will be, okay, I'm going to take that thing I boiled. I'm going to dress it with some buttermilk and some herbs and maybe hit it with a little bit of like grate a little garlic into it. And I'm going to put some of the nice roasted broccoli on top and scramble an egg on top. And like, boom, that's dinner. Maybe shave some cheese. And like dinner's on the table. And
this by the way, is the way that all food people talk. Yeah. They'll be like, this is delicious. They'll be like, oh my God, it's so easy. I just grated some garlic, scrambled some eggs, roasted some vegetables three days ago.
Which of the things I just mentioned is going to take you more than 3.5 minutes?
When you add them all together.
But again,
whenever you hear the word just, whenever the word just comes out of a food person's mouth, you know that they're trying to pull one over on you.
Okay, that's legit, and I totally will take that hit. Because I am the business of making cookbooks. And yeah, we do want to make it. I mean, there are times where I'll say to the author, like, can we take, I mean, I know this is your vision, but can we take 4 ingredients out of this recipe? Just pick 4. I don't care which 4. Just pick 4. Because it's going to look so insane when you open the page and it's 3 rows of ingredients. Like, I get it. I totally get that idea of being wanting to be user-friendly and wanting people to feel like there's this weird balance you have to strike, right? As a food media person, as a person who just likes to talk about food, and certainly as an editor, a cookbook editor, and an editor of recipes, there's a weird balance you have to strike between the fact that you know that most people buy cookbooks, because let's face it, if you just want a recipe for something to make for dinner tonight, you have Google. Like, you don't need to buy a cookbook. Like, I know that, right? So most people buy cookbooks as a part of a different practice in their life outside of just cooking. A lot of people don't cook out of their cookbooks, and that's fine too. A lot of people buy them because of the beautiful pictures, because of the stories. I really focus on the stories in my cookbooks, so that's another issue. But weirdly, when it comes down to it, a lot of people buy cookbooks because it is like so many other things you buy, an expression of like the lifestyle you aspire to, mm-hmm. right? It's an aspirational product.
Right, exactly. I have a million cookbooks and I'll cook out of two,
yeah.
but the other ones are the ones I want to cook out of.
Yeah, but like, and that's meaningful because that actually says, you're saying to yourself, oh, this is not just like in a cheap, flimsy way, this is the kind of person I want to be, but you might say, oh, I like that idea and maybe I won't make that recipe with the full, you know, three columns of ingredients, but maybe I'll take the three things out of it that sounded cool to me that I hadn't heard of before, and I'll play with that on Saturday. You know.
So, are there cookbooks which make it clear that like half of these ingredients are just because this is the, you know, deepest expression of the artistry of the author, and you don't really need that. I mean, can I have like the abridged version of Ottolini saying like you can actually just cut out half of these ingredients and it'll be fine?
I mean, as a general rule, yeah, you could probably cut out. I mean, whatever. There are a lot of cookbooks, so I can't speak to everything. I mean, there are plenty of cookbooks that are like literally five ingredients, 5 minutes. Here's your dinner, right? Like that's the idea. But as a person who cooks, yeah. I mean, if you know how to cook and you know that, like, if you know how to cook to some degree and you know that, oh, getting really nice dark color on something creates this kind of flavor versus, you know, putting it in a cool pan for 3 minutes where it's like cooked through and it won't, like, you know, give you tummy ache eating it, but, you know, you don't get a nice sear, it gives you a different kind of flavor, then yeah, you can absolutely play around with anything in between. And you can play around with, like, if you know what the spices taste like in this recipe and you're like, you know, I love coriander. I don't have any coriander on me. I'm probably not going to be sad that it doesn't have coriander in it. That's fine. But a lot of it is going to be the more you cook, the easier it gets. And I'm sorry to say that because it's a crappy thing to say. But
so, okay, let me ask you about the cookbooks, though. Is it like is there a correlation between the amount that people actually cook out of a cookbook and the amount that it sells? Are the ones which people use the ones which sell the most?
Is there a correlation? I haven't seen a study, so I can't speak to that.
Run a regression.
Yeah, let's run a regression.
Yeah, what's the R squared on that?
I mean, I think probably yes to a large degree, but absolutely not to like an absolute degree, if that makes any sense.
So there are lots of cookbooks which, you know, are mostly decorative and that's fine.
Well, I reject the idea that they're decorative, right? Because I don't think it's about that. I don't think it's about like, oh, I put it there because it looks nice next to like my trinkets. But I think it's, you know, if your idea is decorative is like, oh, you're just reading out of it versus cooking out of it, or you're enjoying sitting down with it on an evening and flipping through the pictures and just imagining that food and what it would taste like. I think those are totally valid uses of a cookbook. And again, like I said, I in particular love working on cookbooks that really tell a story. That really, and in some ways I mean that literally. I mean that in terms of like, oh, the narrative and telling a story behind, you know, a cuisine or maybe a journey through a place and walking you through a region. I worked on a cookbook a couple years ago that came out by the author Ronnie Lundy, and the book is called Vittles, and it's a book about Appalachia, which is the region that she's from. And it is one of the most beautiful documents of place and culture, and one of the most beautiful statements of a person standing up in the world and saying, this is my place and these are my people and you cannot look down on us. And it's told through recipes. It's a tremendously affecting work. And she's a lovely person. I grew like, I'm also incredibly fond of the author, having worked with her. And now I like want to tear up every time I think about this damn book. But you know, maybe you're not going to make the food in that book. Maybe you're not going to make the peas, taters, and cream. I've never cooked out of that book, I'll be honest with you. And I edited it. But I've read it cover to cover five times.
Answer me that one, because I always thought that was like the number one most important thing that cookbook editors did was they cooked every recipe five times to make sure that, like,
no, that's what a recipe worked. Tester does.
Oh, the recipe tester does?
Yeah, I don't mean to be snide, but I mean, like, no, if I had to cook every recipe out of a cookbook five times.
See, I think we have a much more, like, crass question, which is kind of, does anyone really make money off of cookbooks?
A lot of people make a little bit of money.
Right.
Well, so who makes money? Like, in the is it just Ina Garten?
Ina Garten does really well. Ina Garten's success as a cookbook author is at a utterly different scale than literally anyone else.
Tell me, Kenji is making money.
I'm sorry?
Tell me, Kenji is making money, because, like, I worship that book.
I'm sure he's done well. I haven't asked him. I've been looking at his accounts lately, but. But I'm sure
I heard that was like the big blockbuster Norton book of, like, last Christmas.
So this is Kenji, the author of The Food Lab. Kenji.
Yeah.
J. Lopez Alt.
J. Kenji Lopez Alt. And which I love because I'm a nerd and he actually explains why you're doing everything.
Yeah.
And that is missing from most cookbooks.
That's not the point.
Kind
of
like the chemistry of it, but, like, you know, there's me and my nerdy friends who like that. But it's great if you.
Yeah.
But so what is a successful cookbook typically like, and how does that compare, like, a sales wise, like, and how does that compare to, like, other parts of publishing, or do you know?
Well, if you want numbers, I know this is a show about money. It all depends. It depends on a million factors, not least of which is how. The single most important one is actually, from the publisher's point of view anyway, is how much you're actually paying the author to create the book.
Yeah.
But at, like, a, if you've done the math right, or if you've done the math in a sort of, I don't know, it's hard to say actually, because it differs so much from book to book. I'll put it this way. Unless you're really, really, like, doing something weird with, like, paying a ton of money in the advance and so on and so forth, or, like, you're just tricking the book out like crazy, where it, like, you know, you press a button, it opens itself up and it, like, crawls across the counter to you, starts cooking itself. Typically a book that sells 30 to 40,000 copies is a solid success.
And what proportion of cookbooks would you say sell 30 to 40,000 copies?
Well, again, I hesitate to give that number because it's all relative, right? It's relative to all these other factors I just talked about. Like, it's a P&L, right? So, like, you add here, this has got to go up.
Sure, would you say more than a third?
Probably not. I mean, like, you know about the 80-20 rule in, like, all forms of media?
Yeah.
Right. Book publishing is a hits publishing business, and the small number of hits sort of cross-subsidize.
Yeah, so basically 20% of your products will basically make 80% of revenue if you're doing it right. That's kind of what you expect. So that means 80% of your products are losing money. And I think that's a good thing.
It means there are more cookbooks out there. There's a whole bunch of, like, amazing uneconomic cookbooks out there, which you can find in a cookbook
store. No, yeah, that's exactly what it means. Yeah. Because I think it's important to be in an industry that doesn't only look at your bottom line. It's important to be in an industry that recognizes that, okay, we make products and products go into the market for consumers to buy and hopefully make money on, but you're also the industry that creates a tangible part of our culture, that documents our culture and tells the story that Ronnie Lundy wants to tell, or asks the questions. I have another book that I worked on by Alex Tupac and Jordana Rothman called Tacos, Recipes and Provocations. Now, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be self-promotional right now, but I think it's relevant. And it's a cookbook of tacos. But the whole story of the book can be told in one of the recipes. And it is a taco of seared scallops with caper raisin emulsion and caramelized cauliflower. And it's the primary author, Alex Tupac, is a chef and he has restaurants in the city called Empellón. He put it on his menu and people gave him shit. Because they're like, you cannot charge me $24 for two tacos, you goddamn crook. And they just went at him for how much money he was charging for this until he finally said, okay, that dish, the scallops, that sauce, that cauliflower, is literally a dish they have been serving at four-star French restaurant Jean Georges since 1997. It's one of his signature dishes. I called him up, asked him if I could use his recipe. He sent it to me. I buy the scallops from his same supplier. You would never bat an eyelash going to his restaurant and paying $40 for it. You come to mine, I put it on a tortilla. I literally add to the dish, right? I'm actually adding now to the dish.
You get a free tortilla. Yeah.
But now it's a taco, and so therefore, in your mind, it has to be cheap. So what does that say about how we think of Mexican cuisine and, by extension, Mexican culture and Mexican people? You're literally buying the same thing, and you refuse to pay even a tenth of what you pay for this in a French restaurant. So what does that say about our relationship to Mexican cuisine? And the whole book is basically that recipe expanded into 50 different tacos, because he's constantly asking the question of
how it is a well-known fact that any piece, any great meal can be improved by putting it in a tortilla and calling it a taco.
But you know what I'm saying? So like, we're in an industry that's not only making products for profit, but we want to be asking these questions that need to be asked.
Let me ask you one question which isn't being asked, which I found an old Foreign Policy essay by Tyler Cowen about like cookbooks. And he was saying there are 8 million Chinese cookbooks. There are 8 million Mexican cookbooks. There's probably 25 million Indian cookbooks of various descriptions. But for most regional cuisines in the world, for most countries in the world, you're basically going to find zero or one or two, and they're mostly out of print. That there's this herding mechanism in cuisines, and obviously that's every kind of regional cuisine in America, including Appalachia, that we can find. But like, if what we want to do is discover new combinations and flavors and tastes, that's still surprisingly hard in the cookbook world.
Is there a question?
Yeah.
How does that square with what you're saying about, hey, we publish like 80% of our books are uneconomical, and we have this wonderful range of...
But
like,
I think you also have to have countries and cultures where you have enough development and restaurant culture, or just eating out culture, so that you have recipes. Because I think if you don't have that, and you don't have scale, and you don't have standardization... you're going to have most people eating at home, most people teaching other relatives how to cook. So you're not going to have recipes. You don't have recipes if you tell if your grandmother's teaching you how to do something, she's probably not giving you a recipe.
Not unless you're Diana Kennedy anyway.
But yeah, so I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, that article was interesting, because it was kind of like this idea that there's a little bit of like an economic indicator of when a cookbook comes out, that means like that country has reached a certain level of development. And that's why you only see often from a certain range of countries, which I'm curious also if in like the cookbook market, is that starting to expand, or is it still focusing on those kind of core?
And I think it's happened certainly with regional Chinese cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think a couple of things are at play here, right? Because there's both the, well, what will the publishers publish? And it's also like, oh, what stories are people trying to tell, right? And if you grew up in a world where you'd never heard of Uzbeki food, and you know, what is going to be the thing that makes you think, oh my God, my life's work is to tell the world about Uzbek food, right? Or like, you know, you grew up Uzbek, and you were never told your food is worth something to us. Your food is worth your talking about. So what's the thing that makes you say, I need to tell the story of my food, right? So there is a little bit of a little bit of a chicken or egg here. Well, the more that cuisine exists in the media, the more that story is told, the more people feel drawn to it. That means more people want to buy it, and more people want to tell it, right? So it's funny, because on some level, the framework of this conversation can be the exact same framework as, what do we do about diversity in different industries, right? And, well, we just don't get the resumes. Is that really enough of a reason? We don't get the resumes of people who are like this and people who are like that, and not enough people are applying. I'm like, you know, we look through them, and like, if they were good ones, we would hire them. Like, is that enough? Or is the real question, it's the responsibility of those in power to go and seek those voices and develop them, right? And it's the responsibility of those in power who make these choices to make sure that we create a world in which the things that we have power over not only are accessible and open to people, but actually attract all different kinds of people. And in the publishing world, I would say yes. I mean, I would say it's, you know, we are a reactive industry like every other. But on some level, if we do feel like we're an industry that's about creating culture and documenting culture and adding to our cultural conversations, yeah, it's on us to find the author that wants to tell the story of Uzbek food. And it's on us to make the case, make to some degree the economic case, but also make the case to say, like, this is a story that we need to put out in the world. Peace to my Uzbek people. I don't know why that was. Yeah. I don't know why
we're gonna all get Uzbek.
I don't know why I was so down with Uzbek. Any Uzbeks
in the house who want to write a cookbook, like, yeah. Come find Francis after the show.
So I guess I have back to a slightly more less high-minded issue, but I'm curious how many cookbooks actually have their recipes tested. Like, I mean, this is right. I mean, like, to what this seems like. There are a lot of controversies about, you know, ghostwriting, for instance, and just like the process by which cookbook is made. Like, you know, celebrity chef, if a celebrity chef is on the cover of a cookbook, the chances are they did not actually write all the recipes and cook all the food. So, I mean, like, what is the quality control process in the industry like right now, especially given what you're saying about how a lot of people don't buy these books to cook from necessarily, but as a sort of aspirational gesture? Mm-hmm. I mean, what... You know, is there a standardized process, or does it just vary from place to place? And how do you even guess which cookbook is going to be good that you would want to cook from?
Oh, let me carve up that last question. That's a big one. And that's truly a matter of taste and, yeah. You know, whatever. I have bad news for a lot of people, not just about cookbooks, but about the world in general. It's 2017. That sucks. That wasn't the bad news I was here to deliver. Celebrity chefs, if you eat a celebrity chef's restaurant tonight,
yeah, they're not cooking.
They didn't cook your food.
Yeah, it's true.
What?
But you are.
It blows people's minds when, like, you know, Mario Batali famously lives in Greenwich Village, lives in New York City. You know, he tapes his shows here. It blows people's mind when they go to Mario Batali's restaurant in Vegas that, like, he didn't personally stand there and sear their steak for them, and then, like, get on a plane and fly somewhere else.
He's at every restaurant at once. It's like a quantum particle.
If you cannot actually clone yourself, not just the number of times you have restaurants, but literally the number of employees you have in that restaurant, then you are not, like, you know, then that you haven't fulfilled the reality of most, what, like, a lot of people think is true. So yeah, a lot of chefs do not write their own cookbooks.
Yeah.
I don't think that should be controversial in the way that it's, you know, their cooks cook their food in their restaurant.
Well, but so what I'm curious about though is from what I understand, there's sort of a big range in how much role they play at all.
Sure.
Like, you know, how often are they doing even any, are they tasting the food? Are they really editing it, or are they leaving that to someone?
I mean, there's nothing I can say in a blanket way that could address that. There's no trend. I mean, I know some chefs who are, you know, running extremely complicated business ventures, and, you know, I bet when their editor texts them about something in their book, they are like, okay, what do we need to do right now?
Yeah.
What do I want to look at? Like, show me. Or, oh, I'm really sorry, I hated that paragraph and cut it out. I didn't know you needed it. Or vice versa. Oh, I'm really sorry, I meant to say that and I didn't get around to writing it. Like, we're very, very intimately tied to the writing of their books. And I think in particular in like the chefy chef world, so many of these people came up in a way where, you know, they may have worked at different restaurants and try to learn what they could learn, but feel like they got a huge part of their culinary education through reading cookbooks and collecting cookbooks. I know so many chefs who, like, if you go to their home, like, here's my cookbook collection, it'll just be enormous, because that's the thing that really, look, you were cooking and working for like $4.25 an hour, plus your $6 overtime, you're not, you know, and you're working 6.5 days a week, you didn't have your whole life and all the resources to go out and eat all this different food. So like they saw the world through cookbooks. And so they have an extraordinary dedication to the form of the cookbook. And so they feel like when it's time for me to write my cookbook, I'm going to do it right. It doesn't matter how busy I am.
What about the non-chefs? Because you worked with on Chrissy Teigen's cookbook recently. Yeah. Correct? So, I mean, that was a huge seller. And it's actually gotten great. I've eaten some of the food. It's very good. But like, I mean, that's like the prototypical non-chef cookbook, right? I mean, like, what was that like?
You know? Sure. So, I mean, there are definitely cookbooks that are clearly, you know, celebrity brand extensions.
Yeah.
And, you know, no shade on them. Like, you know, if you're a fan of that person, you just feel like I want to get every angle into that person. Like, you know, that person is like my avatar in the world. I'm trying to like pull their weird like cookbook skin over my head. Because that meant something to someone. Or you know what I mean? Like if you're just a super fan and you wanted to be down, like okay, you buy the cookbook and like that meant something to you. That's fine. Yeah. Like I've got no, you know, I've got no problem with that. Like those aren't the books I work on, but that's fine. Chrissy is a, you know, it's funny because she's a celebrity cookbook author. She was obviously a celebrity and then became a cookbook author and then became more famous because she was a great cookbook author. Mm-hmm. And she, I mean, dude, when I worked on that book, her co-writer moved in with her.
Wow.
Lived in her house for months. And they woke up and cooked every day. And I was getting texts from them. And like I flew out to like meet with them for a weekend. And it was like some like insane like Chrissy Teigen, John Legend weekend where like I was going to see them in LA. And then like I got a text like 2 days before. I was like, actually, you know, John is doing some celebrity benefit thing in Napa. Can you like change your ticket? And I was like, my life isn't really like that, dude. Like change fees matter to me. But like, oh, it's like, oh, what time are you landing in LA? Blah, 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 blah. It turns out, okay, well, you can just meet them in the airport and we'll fly together. I was like, yeah, that doesn't solve my problem. Buying a second plane ticket doesn't make it. And they're like, oh, no, you can just get on their plane. I was like, what? Oh, get on their plane. Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was awesome.
Being hands-on was fantastic.
It was rad.
Yeah.
No, and John like came out and like tipped the people who, you know, tip the people who brought the luggage up himself.
Oh, wow.
Like, they're, like, really cool people. Like, really, really cool people. So, anyway, so I spent the weekend with them. And Adina Sussman, who's Chrissy's collaborator, had, like, a family thing and actually had to not be there. So I was there for 2 days, and Chrissy and I cooked for 2 days. Hmm. And it was, like, her and me in the kitchen, and, like, yes, some, like, totally insane delivery of groceries for 2 days. It's just, like, piled in the fridge. Oh, we don't need another fridge. Is there another fridge in this house? Oh, yeah, pile them in. And we're like, do we want to try doing like a raspberry thing? We're like, we got raspberries. It's cool. We got an entire grocery store here. But yeah, and Chrissy and I cooked for 2 days.
Wow.
And that's how 8 of the recipes in the book, you know, came to be. And, you know, so she was intimately involved in that book. And I think for her, it's funny, I've said this whole thing about chefs before. I think she's that person too, where she feels like, I mean, at this point, she obviously didn't grow up this way, but at this point, like, she could go and eat the food of any chef in the world she wanted to probably tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she saw so much of the world that she loved and aspired to through her cookbooks. And when it came time for her to write one, this is my favorite Chrissy story. I actually first reached out to her.
Oh, okay.
And say, hey, would you want to write a cookbook?
So
because I like saw her on Instagram and saw that she tweeted. Like, I first knew of her because she was just so funny on Twitter. And then I saw that she would like Instagram a lot from like what she was cooking for dinner and stuff like that. I was like, oh, hey, you know, would you ever think about writing a cookbook? And she actually said to me, oh my God, I would love to, but I don't have any cred. And I don't, no, really, I don't have any cred. I have no, basically said, like, I have no business writing a cookbook. Like, I'm not a chef. I'm not trained. No one should buy a cookbook from me.
So that may have actually been a good sign in this case.
A great sign.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow. Like, this is someone who, like, would take it seriously if she were to ever do it. And we actually got to the point where she, and a few years later, in fact, she was like, you know what? I actually do think I have something to say. And what that something is, you know, I have all these fans on Instagram and on Twitter and stuff who always tweet back at me and say, like, oh my God, I've never cooked before, but I really want to cook because I see you cook and I think it's cool. And she's like, oh, like it's like this totally normal thing that I do. I'm not going to be great at it. But if I can help inspire people to cook who have never done it before and they can feel that joy and they can feel like this is something they can do for themselves and do for their family or whatever, like I'd feel like I've done something good in the world. And that's the conversation we actually had when it came time for her to say like, okay, let's do this then.
All right. I think with that, everyone here, thank you so much for coming out to Brooklyn. You are awesome. Give yourselves a huge round of applause. We love you all. This is, yeah, I apologize that you're going to have to like listen to this thing all over again on Slate Money in a couple of weeks. You will
relive the magic.
Relive the magic. Fast forward to the good bits. You'll know where they are. And yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for coming out. And go check out the bar because they need your custom in this very sexy, old-fashioned bar place, which I'm sure Teddy would love to have come up with. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Slate Money listeners. This is producer Dan just jumping in with a quick correction. A couple weeks ago, during the numbers round, Anna noted that the air pollution reading in Delhi was 969 micrograms per cubic meter, and Felix stated that's about 1 gram per cubic meter. In fact, he should have said it's about 1 milligram per cubic meter, so we'd just like to issue that correction. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.